From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the sudden death of Sergio Marchionne.
I saw Sergio in Italy at the beginning of June. It's just incredible to think that he's not with us anymore. It really is. It's very surreal.
Larry Nassar wants a new judge and resentencing in Ingham County.
What he is saying, essentially, is that Judge Rosemary Aquilina was not an unbiased and impartial judge.
Like something out of a gangster movie, the 1930 murder of Detroit radio crusader Jerry Buckley.
Someone who held a lot of sway in shaping public opinion. He was known as the mouthpiece of the people.
And Mustard's Retreat, still singing after all these years.
These are trying times. Let's face it, people are upset. And I just want to sing them through it.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Sergio Marchionne has died at age 66. His health suddenly failed following shoulder surgery in June. And last Saturday, he was replaced as Fiat Chrysler CEO by Jeep Chief Mike Manley. With us now is Rebecca Lindland. She's an executive analyst for Kelley Blue Book. Now, Rebecca, Marchionne had already planned to step down next spring, so FCA wasn't caught completely unprepared, was it?
No, not at all, Cynthia. His retirement was planned for April of 2019. But certainly the absolute, really incomprehensible tragedy of his death at such a young age and so suddenly was not in the cards at all. I saw Sergio back in June in Italy at the beginning of June, and it's just incredible to think that he's not with us anymore. It really is. It's very surreal.
How did Marchionne make his mark on the world's auto business? What do you think his signature accomplishments are?
There's a few, and they would be impressive if he only had one, but he had multiple. First of all, he really brought Fiat, the company, back from near death in 2004 when he took over in Italy. It was a company that was struggling. General Motors actually owned 20% of it at the time. And then they were like, what are we doing here? We don't, you know, this is not long for this world. And Marchionne took it over and was able to revitalize it. So much so that 5 years later, in 2009, he then took over Chrysler, which the Obama administration had basically also left for dead and said, forget it, this isn't going to happen. But the commonality between Fiat and Chrysler was that they serve many of the same clients, the same consumers, the same buyers, with a mindset towards a good, reliable vehicle that meets a level of need that's not like super high-end luxury or that's not very commercialized. So they kind of had the same, their consumer had the same mindset, and that really helped draw the companies together and draw everyone within the two companies together, unlike Daimler Chrysler, which was a failed merger with Chrysler.
What was Marchionne's management style like? I mean, he was not your typical auto guy, was he?
He was not your typical auto guy, and he actually did not come from automotive. At one point, he worked for Deloitte & Touche. He really was certainly hard-driving, highly, highly demanding, worked 24/7, but would never ask his fellow man to do something he himself would not do. So he was very admirable in that way. And it was a full-time job working for him, no doubt, and there's no such thing as work-life balance with him. But he challenged people and he gave them opportunities to do their very best, to make themselves successful. And that's why he was such an exciting leader. He was thoughtful, charming. You know, there's a lot. Everyone has, you know, some great story about Sergio, and that can't be said for everybody.
Remembering the late Sergio Marchionne, who has died at age 66. Rebecca Lindland, executive analyst with Kelley Blue Book. Rebecca, thank you so very much for being with us.
Cynthia, thank you so much.
He's serving what amounts to a lifetime sentence for federal child pornography charges, along with sentences after pleading guilty to sexual assault in Eaton and Ingham counties. But Larry Nassar wants a new sentence in Ingham County and wants the judge who sentenced him to be disqualified. Also, attorneys for the former MSU sports doctor say he was assaulted in May after being released into the general population of a federal prison. All of this comes a day after a U.S. Senate subcommittee investigated just how Nassar was able to sexually assault women and girls for years. The senators aimed tough questions at MSU interim president John Engler about his leadership and his dealings with Nassar survivors. With us now, Michigan Radio's Shayna Roth. She was there in Washington for the hearing. Shayna, first tell us about this news today about Larry Nassar.
Yeah, this came out early this morning, and it looks like it was filed yesterday. Nassar is asking to be resentenced in his Ingham County case. And this is the Judge Aquilina case where you had the more than 100 survivors coming forward at sentencing and telling all of their stories. And what he is saying, essentially, is that Judge Rosemary Aquilina was not an unbiased and impartial judge. And because of that, he did not get a fair sentence because, according to Nassar, as soon as he walked in there and as soon as that hearing started, she was out to get him. Aquilina made statements like, "I just signed your death warrant." And so he is saying that he deserves to be resentenced by a different judge.
And indeed, there were think pieces written during that process, kind of questioning her strident tone, shall we say, during the proceeding.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's kind of been a part of Nassar's entire argument. By Aquilina speaking the way she did with the survivors during the hearing, by making all these statements, not just while she was sentencing him, but throughout the proceeding, that he was treated unfairly.
So what comes next?
So he has filed these motions. He wants the resentencing and the appointment of a new judge. And it looks like those motions are going to be scheduled for hearings in August. So it's going to be up to a judge to decide what happens next and if these motions have merit.
So, Shayna, let's talk about what happened yesterday in that Senate hearing room in D.C. We have seen and heard clips of the senators and John Engler. You were there, though. What was the atmosphere in the room like, considering so many of the survivors were right there?
You know, it was a little tense. I mean, it was a packed room there, not just for John Engler, but also for officials from USA Gymnastics and the Olympic Committee, which have also come under fire for their association with Nassar and some of their prior practices. At one point, though, one of the senators asked the survivors to stand up, and there were about 80 of them, to stand up in the room and be recognized, and there was applause. And it was interesting to have that many survivors in the room because, I mean, I don't know how many committee hearings you've watched on C-SPAN, but usually they are very quiet, they're very reserved. But there were several times during the hearing where there was just an outburst of applause when a senator would make a very poignant comment.
So, Shayna, what kind of questions did the senators ask Engler? What were they getting at?
Initially, they wanted to know what are some of the policies that you have put into place that is going to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. And Engler was happy to share all of the different changes that have been made at the school since he started there 6 months ago. But then, you know, things very quickly turned into some of the things that Engler himself has done and some of the missteps that he's made during that time. That includes an email that got out where Engler said that, you know, these survivors might be being manipulated by trial lawyers. And then in that same email, he said that maybe Rachel Denhollander was getting a kickback. And Denhollander is one of the first women to come forward and accuse Nassar publicly. So that was something that was brought up. Another thing that was brought up, and he was very rigorously questioned on, was a private meeting that he had with Kaylee Lorenz. Lorenz says that her and Engler met with a couple other people in the room and he offered her money to end her civil lawsuit. She's a part of this massive lawsuit against the school with more than 300 other survivors. And Engler was questioned about that multiple times, and he said, "We never talked about money." And that, of course, afterwards made the survivors very upset and very frustrated because they say that he's calling Lorenz a liar.
And afterwards, you spoke with Kaylee Lorenz?
I did, and she was very frustrated with not just what Engler said about her, but about his performance in general and how he presented himself in front of the committee. And this is what she had to say in reaction to Engler's statements that they never talked about money.
I was extremely shocked about the fact where he said that he never talked about money at all during that meeting. And that is a straight lie. Like, it was a 45-minute meeting, and I'm telling you, 35 minutes of that meeting was all about money.
And you also had a chance to get a reaction on the Kaylee meeting from survivor Morgan McCall.
She was definitely not impressed with Engler and very frustrated with him. And honestly, what she has to say kind of speaks for itself.
I think he is perhaps one of the most disgusting men that I've ever seen in my entire life. And I absolutely stand with Kaylee. I believe Kaylee. And I don't know why anyone would choose to prioritize John Engler's character over Kaylee's at any point, given his record and his behavior.
Well, yeah, boy, pull no punches there. What did Morgan McCall say to you about the way the senators questioned Mr. Engler?
She was happy with how the senators performed and with how they questioned Engler. She said afterwards that, you know, they were really hoping for the senators to rise to the occasion and to not pull any punches with Engler. And this is her reaction to that.
I think he was very gloating and bullish about the way that he was really touting his accomplishments. But I think that the senators saw right through him and they didn't buy it. It was a lot of PR. It was a lot of what we expected. And so I feel happy that they didn't entertain him.
So, Shana, does John Engler have any more hearings ahead in Washington? Because this is an ongoing investigation by Congress. Can he look forward to any more committee hearings?
Not that I know of. This is the third of several committee hearings that they've done, is sort of this investigation into what happened. It's possible that they could bring him back in, but at this point, we just don't know. And Engler's time at MSU is starting to run out. He is just the interim president, and there is a search going on for a permanent president. And during the committee hearing, Engler said he hopes they find a new president quickly.
Michigan Radio's Shana Roth from yesterday's hearing in Washington. Thank you so much, Shana.
Thanks for having me.
Just like many other states, Michigan is at a kind of crossroads when it comes to marijuana policy. Of course, the drug is still illegal at the federal level, but public opinion is changing. More than 60% of Americans now favor legalizing weed. And of course, this November, Michiganders will vote on whether to allow recreational marijuana use. So what does all this mean for the state's economy, for healthcare, our criminal justice system? Let us know your questions about the future of marijuana here in Michigan. Go to MichiganRadio.org and look for the Stateside question box on the right side of the page. Stay with us. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history. Today, a Michigan tale involving a radio personality, a mayoral recall, city corruption, and an unsolved murder that happened this week in 1930. We welcome back state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, and author and expert on organized crime in Michigan, Scott Bernstein. Really happy to have both of you here to talk history.
Thank you.
I love doing these. I love looking back and being able to chop it up with people like yourself.
Absolutely. So, Mark, we're talking about Jerry Buckley, a Detroit radio personality who launched his broadcasting career in 1928. Just to kind of set the stage for us, tell us what the medium of radio was like in the Detroit of the 1920s.
I guess I sort of equate it to what the atmosphere must have been like during the space race. There was just a lot of excitement around it. That might be because I love radio, but it was new, it was exciting, it was like nothing they had seen before or experienced. Commercial radio really didn't appear on a national scale till the end of the decade. NBC took off in 1926, CBS in 1927. There was just an incredible buzz about this communication tool that was changing how people lived.
So if you are someone on radio in Detroit, Scott, you are the focus of a lot of attention.
Yeah, Jerry Buckley was a budding superstar in this burgeoning new medium, someone who held a lot of sway in shaping public opinion. He was known as the mouthpiece of the people, and he came from a law enforcement background. So he was, I believe, he naturally gravitated towards the law and order and politics and, you know, those issues of the day.
So that takes us to you, Mark. Take us back to Detroit in the late 1920s.
So Charles Bowles was the mayor in 1929, 1930, but I think it's important to note that Detroit was a complex city at this time. The immigrant population was swelling. The auto industry is in full bloom and is creating lots of wealth and lots of opportunity in this city. And it's an international city, right? And here you have Charles Bowles, who he was a lawyer and he ran for mayor in 1925 unsuccessfully, backed by the Ku Klux Klan, interestingly. And he didn't win and became a recorder's court judge, so still a position of sway. And then he went back and ran again and won the office without the support of the Klan in 1929. He seems like an antagonist right out of a gangster movie, right from the get-go. He starts his administration on the heels of the Great Depression by doing things like cutting public assistance programs and raising streetcar fares and really not doing a whole lot about the rising crime wave. In fact, Bowles created a special vice squad unit that some felt applied the law unevenly, that's to say the least. Huh. And he had a penchant for political favoritism, saying that only members of his Odd Fellows Lodge could be appointed manager of the street railway system. So one of his most famous sayings is when pressed on the rising violent crime, Bowles quipped that, like parasites, the solution may be just to let the criminals kill each other.
You know, in terms of the underworld, he was at the center of this tug of war between warring gangland factions that were trying to, you know, puppet him. And Jerry Buckley was someone that was on one side of that tug of war and advocating for his removal.
And so that led to this move to recall the mayor. And so how was Jerry pushing that on the airwaves?
Well, he was, you know, using his bully pulpit to rally the troops, if you will, you know, get the population of Detroit up in arms and angry about a corrupt mayor.
And
he was successful. The mayor was recalled.
And the recall election, it happened July 22nd, 1930. And so the mayor was recalled, right,
yeah.
Mark?
Yeah. I think the final percentage was 57% voted to remove him. But what's interesting and important to remember is that that didn't put him immediately out of office. That just queued him up for a special election in September, which Bowles only lost by about 13,000 votes to Frank Murphy. And then he actually challenged it and asked for a recount, which he didn't get. But he recovered quickly. By 1931, he was back on the bench of the recorder's court as a judge, which, you know, was still a pretty influential position.
So, Scott, tell us what transpired later the night following the vote.
So, Buckley did his radio show at the top floor of the LaSalle Hotel, which was at the corner of Woodward and Adelaide, which now occupies the townhouses that are a couple blocks north of Ford Field and Comerica Park and Little Caesars Arena. It was originally constructed as the Savoy Hotel, then it became the LaSalle, eventually it was the Detroiter, but it's been torn down since the mid-1990s. But at the time, it was a luxurious hotel. It was a place that was a kind of a beehive of activity and a lot of buzz and excitement around this, you know, this new hotel. And Buckley broadcast from the hotel, and after he had gotten off the air that night and after the results of the recall had been reported, he was having a drink at the bar down at the LaSalle Hotel, and as he was walking out in the lobby, he was gunned down by two gunmen, and, you know, kind of all hell broke loose that evening, and it was a capper on what had been an incredibly violent couple weeks. It was known in the press as Bloody July. There were a dozen gangland murders in that time period, and so it really served to galvanize public opinion towards, you know, this real issue with violence in the bootlegging industry in Detroit.
And so how did people react to Jerry Buckley being murdered?
Well, this would be like if, you know, Mitch Albom was slain or Charlie the LaDuff was killed after getting off the air. He was a celebrity. You know, he was someone that had a lot of cachet and someone who's, wherever he went, doors were open for him. And people wanted to shake his hand and people wanted to pal around with him. So, you know, people were shocked.
So there was a lot of focus and a lot of pressure. What about arrests?
There ended up being a number of arrests, all pretty, you know, prominent gangland figures in Detroit. At the end of the day, I believe there might have been about a half dozen people that were either brought in for questioning or arrested, but only three stood trial. Angelo Lavecchi, Ted Pizzino, mm-hmm. and Scarface Joe Bomarito. They were all members of a bootlegging contingent known as the River Gang. And the River Gang was led by the Licavoli brothers, Horseface Pete Licavoli and Thomas Yanni Licavoli, who were also brought in for questioning but never charged. But Scarface Joe Bomarito was their aide-de-camp, their main emissary on the street, as someone that was a vicious criminal with a lot of bodies on his resume. And the three of those guys stood trial but were acquitted.
And anything happened, Mark, as far as response from the governor, at a statewide response?
Yeah, the governor at the time was Fred Green, and he was so upset about the shooting that he flew to Detroit and ordered the state police to investigate the murder independently of the Detroit police. He didn't trust their ability to investigate it. And then he also threatened to call out the National Guard, which was a pretty new organization at that point, if necessary, to stop the killings in Detroit. It was the 11th or 12th murder in about 19 days.
What do you think happened, Scott?
Ironically, Jerry Buckley was someone that went on the airwaves and railed against graft. And in reality, he was immersed in graft himself. He was a bought and paid for member of the media. Whoever was greasing his palm the best was the one that got the results that they wanted. Gangland figures that he was friends with and business associates with wanted to leverage their access to him to get certain issues advocated for on the airwaves.
Not quite the righteous crusader.
Well, I think that he was a Pied Piper of propaganda. If you were buddies with him, he would go on the air and do your bidding. In this case, he was doing the bidding of people that wanted to get Charles Bowles kicked out of office. But there was another side of that, which were the gangsters that were backing Charles Bowles. And they were upset, and they took it out on him and murdered him in retaliation for that media campaign to remove Bowles from office.
Author and Michigan organized crime expert Scott Bernstein and state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, giving us historical context to the murder of Detroit radio personality Jerry Buckley, gunned down in a Detroit hotel lobby this week in 1930. Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you.
For more than 40 years, the group Mustard's Retreat has been carrying the banner of folk music as a way to share what's in the human heart, a way to speak truth to power and to call out injustice. Well, their newest album is out. It's called Make Your Own Luck, and they are with us now, Libby Glover, Michael Huff, and David Tamulevich. It is a pleasure to say welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Very glad to have you here. David, you've been quoted as saying folk music is at its heart defiantly hopeful, and indeed you are on the Defiantly Hopeful Tour. So
that's right.
What's got you feeling defiant?
Oh, defiantly hopeful. I think that's what folk music is all about. I mean, I think Pete Seeger said that, you know, there are defeats. There are always going to be defeats. It's what you do after the defeat and how you carry on. And I think that's what folk music is about.
Mr. Rogers said, you know, whenever there's something bad happens, look for the people who are helping. He said that so kids wouldn't be scared, you know, and we're all in this together. It's like, so we all have to remember that.
I think it's harmony. I think it's harmony. All about harmony.
Yeah,
harmony.
Good answer.
And Libby, how do you describe the kinds of messages in this new CD, Make Your Own Luck?
Well, it's a positive message. It's a way to go forward. It's a way to feel better, to let your blood pressure down a little. These are trying times. Let's face it, people are upset. And I just want to sing them through it.
Yeah, the first song is called I'm Gonna Walk It With You. It's like the fact that we need this. Sometimes when we play, people come up after a show and they say, oh my God, we needed this.
Well, it looks like it might be a hard road, but I'm gonna walk it with you. And I know you might have a heavy load, but I can carry some too. I will lift you up when they push you down. I will raise my voice, stand my ground. Well, it looks like it might be a hard road, but I'm gonna walk it with you.
You know, I think about the history of Mustard's Retreat. And, you know, David, this was a group born in the 1970s. You're not the kids anymore. Time has marched on. And I'm wondering, how do you feel your approach to your music and your writing and your audiences. How has that changed over the decades now that you're not the kids?
You know, I don't think it's changed at all. Because, I mean, we never set out to be anything that we aren't. You know, we sing the things we like. We write about things that move us. And I mean, I know I got into this. This is the folk world is my community of choice. You know, I was so thrilled by Pete Seeger and in the 60s, what those people were singing about. I mean, it was community and compassion and doing the right thing and making the effort.
When you think of, you mentioned Pete Seeger, and I'm just thinking of the music that I grew up listening to, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Bob Dylan, and Joan Baez, and Buffy St. Marie, and the list can goes on and on. And I think of them pushing for civil rights, pushing for an end to the Vietnam War. What causes do you feel, Michael, should be tackled now in 2018 through folk music?
Well, think about Operation Respect. Sometimes we open shows for Peter Yarrow, and he's got this thing going called Operation Respect, which is a way to just let's think of a better way to deal with bullying. I mean, it's like it names it. It puts a name on something that once we have a name on it, we can wrestle it. So that's
and sing about it.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes.
What about you, Libby? What kind of causes? What's 2018?
For me, I was born and raised in Flint, a great choral structure in the Flint public school system in the 60s, wonderful money funneling through for the students. And for me, it's just a heartbreak, Flint. And when David brought Take the Children to the band, I thought to myself, well, here's a way that Mustard's Retreat, who Flint has been very, very good to us since the first minute I ever took them back to Flint so proudly. And just a wonderful, the Flint Folk Music Society, etc. So anything that we can do to make sure that no one forgets the Flint water crisis, that's where I'm headed.
Let's take a listen now to Take the Children and Run.
They say they'll fix it if we only stay calm. Go back to your factories, go back to your homes. Don't get excited, don't you lose your cool. And those bosses will share their power with you. Take the children and run. Take the children and run.
That is powerful. And what did you want to say in that piece of work about
that
Flint?
Song was actually written by another songwriter, Don Lang, who wrote it about the Three Mile Island disaster. And I had a radio show in Flint, and I used to play that song a lot. And when, again, like Libby was saying, when this happened, we wanted to do something. And I loved that song. And I asked Don, I said, can I adapt this? So I rewrote a verse and some of the lines in that song.
And let's please give a shout out to Christine Lavin, who made a wonderful video.
She made a great video
for it. You can find that on YouTube or on the Mustard's Retreat.
I do love, just as you're these things you're saying, that there is a sense of camaraderie among the performing arts community in our state. People stick
deep
together.
Abiding love.
Deep,
I would say deep abiding love.
We're all in this together.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, there is room for fun in Mustard's Retreat music. Michael, tell us about My Daddy Ain't My Daddy Anymore.
Well, you know, it is what they say about country music. All you need is three chords and the truth.
I saw an ad for Ancestry. I thought it would be fun to take a DNA test and find my origin. I spit into a little tube and put it in the mail. When my results came back to me, I started down this trail. My daddy ain't my daddy anymore.
People are, with this ancestry thing, people are finding out a lot more, like too much information kind of things. Unexpected. They don't tell you that in the advertisements on the TV. No, they don't. But it's all there. And now there are support groups for people who are finding out more than they thought they ever wanted to with the ancestry thing. But that's, you might as well laugh.
David, for people just discovering you, tell us where the name Mustard's Retreat came from.
When I first came to Ann Arbor in 1972, I worked at the undergraduate library, and my supervisor there was named Nancy Mustard. Mustard is an old Ann Arbor family. She was a guitar player. I was just learning to play, and she showed me this little slide on the guitar. I went home, I wrote a tune and used that slide, and I thought, well, I'll let me name this after her. And so there's an old fiddle tune called Bonaparte's Retreat. So I just took it, Mustard's Retreat, and forgot about it.
When I think of Mustard's Retreat, what I think of is, I think of it as a place that you'd like to go. It's like you go down the two-lane road, you turn right at the Red Barn, go down the two-track, you turn left at the boulder, up between the trees, up along that ridge drive, and on the other side of that ridge is Mustard's Retreat. It's a place that you'd like to go.
Well, the CD is Make Your Own Luck, and it will take you to that special place known as Mustard's Retreat. And there are a bunch of dates. You're busy, busy, busy around Michigan and elsewhere. So you can go to their website, mustardsretreat.com. And by the way, no comma in the mustards, mustardsretreat.com. Libby Glover, Michael Huff, and David Tamulevich, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, we look back at the uprising that took place in not Detroit, but Grand Rapids 51 years ago today. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When a rebellion exploded on 12th Street in Detroit on July 23, 1967, cities all around Michigan watched as bullets flew, windows were smashed, and buildings burned. 2 days later, 51 years ago this day, it was Grand Rapids' turn. This morning, Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman visited the area around Delaware Street Southeast and South Division Avenue, the area where it all began, and asked people walking by if they knew anything about the 1967 uprising.
No, I don't. What happened?
There was a lot of fires and stuff like that.
Honestly, no. I had no idea.
They was coming down the street and just acting a fool, just like any other riot. You know, they just got out of hand.
There was a lot of bloodshed in the riots. I think that it was just a lot of people really fighting and standing up for us to actually have equal rights.
I guess it started because the riots over there and the other places that was going on at the same time.
What happened in Grand Rapids wasn't as deadly as what happened in Detroit, but those 3 days of violence left 44 people hurt and 350 people arrested. This leads to a question that we got from listener Aaron David Werner. He's originally from Alpena, and he was a pastor at St. Luke's Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids for 6 years. Take a listen.
What is the true story of the people involved in the 1967 race riots in Grand Rapids?
So to answer that question, we spoke with two men who were there right in the middle of the Grand Rapids uprising on this date in 1967. Dan Gross was working as a probation officer at the time. And Victor Gillis, a retired Grand Rapids police captain, well, back in that summer of 67, he was working as a patrol officer. Both men joined us in May at our live show in Grand Rapids. Dan and Victor, welcome so much. Good to have you with us. Thank you. So, Dan, what do you remember about Grand Rapids in the months leading up and before the uprising? I'm wondering what people in the African-American community were feeling and some of the challenges they faced.
I can't say specifically for what they were feeling, but I know that there were concerns about what was occurring in the community. There were concerns about economic conditions, housing conditions, health conditions. All those kinds of things were at the forefront of the thoughts of people within the community.
And Victor, how did you see the city? What do you remember from that era before?
I was a new officer, a young officer, and I think initially when the trouble started that nobody thought it would leave Detroit. It would never come here. We didn't have problems here. And there was a naivete about it that it's on the east side of the state. Maybe there was reasons that occurred over here. We don't have those kind of problems. We were surprised.
So there was kind of a thank God that's not us.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later, it was.
And we were so ill-prepared for anything. There were the people who made decisions, who were in charge at the time. My suspicion today is that they felt the same way. It would never happen because when it did, we didn't have equipment. They weren't doing planning. They didn't have rosters changed. It was like a surprise, and it shouldn't have been.
When we think of the day that the uprising began in Grand Rapids, so we're talking July 25th, 1967, Dan, what do you think sparked the unrest?
Well, I've always thought of it as spontaneous combustion. There was an incident that I heard about where an officer arrested, I don't know if it's a young adult or a teenager, and they felt excessive force would be used. And from that sparked the conditions that occurred and continued to spread, and they just kind of went on and...
It mushroomed from there?
Just mushroomed from there.
So in a sense, not terribly different from Detroit's blind pig raid on 12th Street.
It wasn't planned. There was no planning or people getting together said we're going to do something. It was spontaneous, and people responded. They just reacted.
And I understand you lived on Cass Street.
I lived on Cass and Pleasant.
Right in within the area.
In the area, I attended Central High School.
Okay. So what's the strongest, most indelible memory that you hold still from those 3 days?
Well, I was a probation officer at juvenile court, and so one of the main things I was attempting to do was making sure that the young people I was dealing with were not involved or putting themselves in a position to get arrested. And so I was out on the street and walking up and down Jefferson and things. But one of the most memorable things was there was an edict out about porch lights being off. And I guess my parents had left the porch light on and our porch light got shot out. And that was, rather alarming kind of thing because I had not seen that before.
And Victor, when you think of the memories that you still hold and that are very fresh 51 years later,
very fresh.
What are they?
Well, at the time, you got to remember this is the middle of July. It's very hot. It's a weekend. Division Avenue is busy any time of the year. This was terribly busy. And I think everybody out there, whether they're police or community, whoever, was aware of what was happening in the rest of the state. And I think tensions were high to begin with. My first recollections were the fires. Actually, your spontaneous is correct because prior to any kind of physical confrontation, the fires started. There was a couple of fires on Division Avenue. Crowds grew, and out of that, the crowds became more agitated. In your sense, you can understand the reasons for the lack of opportunity and how all that plays into it. I mean,
you look back from that half century perspective and it looks different.
It looks different. But at the time, it was the fire started, the people in the community would band together in groups, then the rock throwing started, and there may have been action reaction on either side. And then within a very short time, you've got a real problem.
Let's add another voice to this. We recently spoke with Reverend Harold Morris. He was working for General Motors at the time of this 67 uprising, and let's listen to his most vivid memory of those days.
Me and my friend Fred Brown, we played basketball together, and we was on Jefferson, and I was most interested in why were they having a riot, and maybe I spoke too boldly. And then the state police asked us to leave. And we proceeded to go up from Franklin. And that's when the shots rang out. And I was shot in the shoulder. I think that the idea was of being black as being we were shot.
So Harold Morris was shot in the shoulder, his friend Fred Brown shot in the jaw. This is for both of you. What would you say the relationship was like between police in Grand Rapids and the African-American community at that time in that summer of 67. Victor?
You know, nothing jumps out at me as it being that bad. But again, take that in the context of you're a 20-year-old. I lived in the city of Grand Rapids. I went to a Grand Rapids school. I was involved in sports and other things. So all this wasn't different for me in working in the city. Of course, you realize that there are different reasons, that stuff. But I didn't think they were bad enough that this would occur. He mentioned on that short recording about the state police. That was probably a very tactical error by the city of Grand Rapids at the time.
Let's talk about that. Why? Well, calling in the state police.
Right? We were not, our staffing could not handle it. The department was quite small at the time. In fact, the department has never grown like it should have. I've been away from it for quite a while, but the staffing was inadequate to do what we had to do. And the state police sent us 100 troopers out of Detroit. You had 100 people who'd been in some real nasty situations in Detroit, and many of them, when they got here, hadn't even, you know, they'd been on duty for 30 and 40 hours, and it was a bad, they were very angry, and their response was quite heavy. I remember on Jefferson Avenue, they wrote in 5-foot letters, "Go home, state police." That's one. I don't want to blame this whole thing on them or that, but that was a tactical mistake at the time. They were very aggressive, and you can't take somebody out of a week of a terrible situation on the east side of the state and throw them into here and think it's going to be. It wasn't.
And Dan, what's your take on the relationship between police and the community?
Well, I think, as he mentioned, the state police, when they came in, it was very militaristic. And they were just shouting orders. In fact, they were the ones who shot out the lights on our porch. But I think the relationship with the police, it had shifted at one time when they used to have the Youth Commonwealth in Grand Rapids. It was on Wealthy Street. And the relationship between police officers was quite different. And I think it had moved more towards impersonal kinds of contacts with people rather than the person-to-person conflict. And, you know, I remember times when little kids would wave at a police officer and they'd turn their head and wouldn't even pay attention to them. And so it wasn't that great. It wasn't that great. And they, you know, people basically saw them as enforcement. And that was about it.
All right. Where do you think we are today?
Well, I'm not out like mm-hmm. I used mm-hmm. to be. I'm aware of some of the meetings that have been held recently in the community. And I had a colleague who's a female attorney share with me that we're still litigating or talking about stuff we were talking about 50 years ago. And so they have not viewed a great deal of improvement in terms of what happened, and come with a couple of incidents that happened with, you know, the 4 young kids mm-hmm. who were, guns were pointed out, and the little girl who was put in handcuffs. And so I think those kinds of things tend to ring out and cast some doubts about the relationship.
Vic, did you see things evolve through your career? I know you're retired now, but through your years and
you know, after the incidents in the 60s, my own feelings were it declined. The relationship probably declined, maybe for 8 or 10 or 12 years, and then I think it started. It's a long curve. So I'll quote somebody. It's a long curve, and I think it has gone better since. Is it perfect? I'm not that foolish to say that. And will there be problems, and are there going to be conflicts and differences of opinion? But I think it's better. I think it's better, particularly in the last probably 20-something years. I think there's more of a realization what I mean, you're going to get someplace eventually. And you've got to start realizing that there are reasons things happen. There has to be some kind of meeting of each other and what you think and how you treat one another.
We should certainly strive to learn from history. Do you think that has happened in Grand Rapids?
I think it somewhat. I'm a lover of history. And I think there's a real dearth of knowledge in terms of history of our country. And I don't see people really expanding their knowledge in terms of what happens or the kinds of events that have happened in our country for them to have the understanding. You know, I still think about the Kerner Commission report, that the cause of problems was white racism and some of the interactions between the police. And so, you know, the Kerner Commission report was a fine document, but people have not embraced it and have not grown with it.
Final thought from you, Vic. Have we learned from history?
Yes, we have. And I think things will. Are they perfect? No. Will they improve? I do believe so. I'm an optimist. And yes, I do. I think we improve all year after year. Too bad we can't impart our wisdom on 25-year-olds. But we can't. I mean, I think of things a whole lot different today than I did 15 or 20 years ago. And I understand things I didn't take the time to understand. Yeah, they'll do better.
Well, there we go. We want to thank you so much, Dan Gross, Victor Gillis. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside and sharing your memories of that summer of 67. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Megan Abbott has been writing crime fiction for more than a decade, with two major TV adaptations in the works. Many are calling Abbott Hollywood's next big novelist. Abbott grew up in the Detroit area and graduated from the University of Michigan, and then headed off to New York University for her PhD in English and American Literature. Her new novel, Give Me Your Hand, centers on two young scientists and their high school friendship poisoned by a deadly secret. Writer Keith Taylor has this review.
People who are insistent on dividing books into categories have labeled Megan Abbott's eight earlier novels as crime fiction, or maybe even as thrillers. Abbott's books have done quite well, so I'm sure she doesn't mind how the books are pigeonholed. This new one, however, Give Me Your Hand, might be a little harder to stick in one single place. There is a crime in the book, a murder, or maybe three of them, maybe even four. And those crimes reverberate across time, shaping the lives of Abbott's two protagonists. The crimes drive the plot, and this book has an exquisite plot. Abbott has always been good at bringing the reader into her stories, but now she might be on her way to becoming a master of the craft. Think Michigan's own Elmore Leonard, or even one of Abbott's heroes, Raymond Chandler. Megan Abbott might be getting close to that heady company. In Give Me Your Hand, we are also drawn deep into the psychology of these women, into dark places that are way beyond any easy explanations. Frightening places. Abbott finds her stories in different types of women. In Dare Me, a novel from a few years back, she wrote about the fraught world of teenage cheerleaders. In Give Me Your Hand, she has entered another hornet's nest, this one the world of research biologists, where very smart people compete for grants and postdocs and laboratory positions in the places that are doing cutting-edge science. It's a world where women have been excluded for far too long. And breaking that barrier adds another tension in the lives of Diane Fleming and Kit Owens, the two brilliant young scientists who are the protagonists of the novel. Kit and Diane have known each other since high school. They competed for the best grades, and they competed for the best scholarships to college. But their relationship has been poisoned by a deadly secret that Diane shares. Kit feels she can't tell anyone else, but she can't really live with the knowledge of the secret either. A new research project brings them back together, and then things start to get frightening. I don't want to give anything more away, but I can guarantee that you will be drawn into these lives, the crimes that rise out of them, and the understanding that comes in the end when most of the secrets are revealed.
Keith Taylor recently retired from teaching at the University of Michigan. He has authored 17 books or chapbooks. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joey Heron, Sarah Leeson, Sam Corey, Gabby Horton, and Sophie Sherry. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.